Is this one on?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Today, I'm going to start this series of talks with some reflections on mindfulness. I'm sure many of you are familiar with this word. Some of you may have been practicing it for many years. But it's useful, I think, to go back to the earliest sources we have and to look at it afresh, to rethink it. So often when we get used to an idea, after a while it just becomes habitual. We assume we know what it means. We don't think about it much anymore. And especially when a term, in this case mindfulness, starts developing a usage that goes beyond just that of meditation on retreats, and now we find mindfulness popping up everywhere. It's being utilized in therapy, in healthcare. And we were in Holland a few weeks ago, and one of the retreatants had a son, a little boy of 10, who was very keen on football. And he came home one evening with a project from his football coach on mindful footballing. So the word is beginning to spread into the culture in ways that will probably generate new meanings, much in the way that the word yoga has come to have meanings now that probably were not those of Patanjali. So it's good, I think, to come back to the sources. And perhaps the first thing to bear in mind that mindfulness may not actually be the best way to translate the term sati or smriti in Sanskrit. If you go to Delhi, New Delhi, there's a place called the Gandhi Smriti, which means Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi. Smriti means means memorial here. It's the memorial to Gandhi. It's in the Birla garden where, in fact, he was assassinated. And there's a statue there of Gandhi and little concrete steps that show his very last steps on earth to the place where he was shot. Now, the word smriti is exactly the same as the word sati, which we translate as mindfulness. But it's unlikely that we would think of such a thing as a mindfulness of Gandhi. It's a memorial to Gandhi. It is literally a memory, a remembrance, a recollection of Gandhi. We come to this place in order to recollect the life of this great man. We think about him, the qualities that his life embodied are brought to mind again. And this is so much the importance of memorials, is because they bring to mind things that we're otherwise likely to forget. And a great deal of religious behavior and religious language is about reminding us, causing us to recollect what we value. we might think of ourselves as good Buddhists or Jews or Muslims or whatever, but so often we can pass our days without really recollecting what that means. So, for example, at 12 o'clock today, we will hear the muezzin chanting, calling the faithful to prayer. And that is, as it were, to interrupt the course of our daily activities, our preoccupations, our angers, our fears, our desires, and we hear that call and we recollect, we remember that there are other values, higher values than those that we spend our day indulging, that at that point and at other points during the day we formally recollect. And in Islam this means that we pray or we bow in the direction of Mecca. And this is true of all traditions. We need to be reminded, and the public presence of religion in a society are really public reminders of what really counts in life. We may struggle with some of their teachings, we may not like everything they say, but it somehow grounds us. It makes us reflect, it makes us think about what really matters in our life. And this, I think, is one of the great difficulties in a purely secularized society, is that those reminders are either ignored or in some cases they become invisible. You see, for example, if you wander through London today, many churches that previously would have been reminders of Christ, of, remember, the word church means the body of Christ. But nowadays, they don't have any congregations, and so they get turned into apartment blocks, or bingo parlours, or, in one case I saw the other day, a Hindu temple, which is at least is a still a kind of reminder. But I think it's fair to say it's a bit of a mixed message. But the point is that such reminders are very valuable. Why? Because as human beings, we seem to be very prone to forget. Remembrance or recollection is our way of counteracting that tendency to forget. Forgetfulness of our deepest values, forgetfulness of the true purpose of one's life, forgetfulness of our history, forgetfulness of our religion. In Plum Village, which is a Buddhist community not far from where we live in southwest France, there's a teacher called Thich Nhat Hanh, and they have what he calls mindfulness bells. At points during the day, sometimes rather arbitrarily, a bell will ring. And this is again designed to help us recollect, to remember. And so when the bell rings, everybody stops and they breathe in and out three times. And they stop talking, they stop doing whatever they're doing, and they just recollect that they're breathing. In daily life, Thich Nhat Hanh sometimes encourages all bells to be mindfulness bells. So if the telephone rings, and you're in the house of somebody practicing this way, they will not, as we would, grab the phone, but they will stop and breathe in and out 3 times to remember that they're breathing, and then they'll pick up the phone. So recollection and means whereby we can be helped in recollecting are very much what this word mindfulness means. But I suspect that that association is not obvious. We often think of mindfulness as just being attentive all the time. Strictly speaking, that's not actually what the word means. It means to recollect, to remember, as a counter force to that much stronger force within us to forget. Now, a very simple example of this, a practical example, is when we're sitting here in meditation. We may be given the very simple instruction, pay attention to your breath. Be aware that you're breathing. Experience the breath as it comes in through the nostrils, fills the body, and leaves the body. We do that for maybe a couple of minutes when we first sit down, and it seems easy enough. And then suddenly, 10 minutes have gone somewhere. We've been carried away on a tide of forgetting. Some little thought, or big thought, or feeling, or worry, or expectation, whatever it is, has somehow managed to creep into our minds, very often without our noticing it, in fact, almost always without our noticing it, and the next thing we know is the bell rings, or somebody opens the door, or we notice we have a pain in our knee. And it could have been that 5-10 minutes or more have passed. Sometimes we can't even remember what it was that we were thinking about, what it was that was distracting us. It's as though we've actually lapsed into a state of non-consciousness. We've become somehow unconscious. It's a blank. There may be a few vestiges of something that went on, but very often we've actually already forgotten what it was that caused us to forget to meditate, even though it must have been terribly exciting at the time. It's already gone. Now, of course, for much of our lives we don't notice that. We don't notice it because, quite obviously, we are in an inattentive, not noticing kind of state. We're running on automatic. There's nothing particular to do here. We don't have anybody else or any task that's going to be demanded of us. It's quiet, it's silent, so we just drift. We just cruise along on the wave of thought, or what the Buddha calls the flood of attachments, of desires. It's a way to entertain ourselves, perhaps. But we're not actually conscious. And what meditation makes us aware of sometimes, particularly when we begin it, is how unconscious our lives often are. I've had people come to me on their first retreat in a state of some considerable anxiety, and they say, "This meditation is making me terribly forgetful. It's not like this most of the time." Well, the trouble is, it is, but you don't notice. Imagine, for example, that you drive to work in the morning. Now, if you have done this a million times, which you probably have, then you get in your car or you get on the bus, and the next thing you know, you're at the office or at the workplace, wherever you go. And if you were asked to recall, you know, what happened on that journey, it would be the same as when you drift off in meditation. You wouldn't really know. You may not have noticed anything in particular. It was just the journey to work. And as you did that, because you're confident that it's just the journey to work, you dream, you daydream, you space out, you drift. And you're not, therefore, actually conscious of what's going on. There's a big kind of gap in your life where nothing really has happened. You have not, in those moments, really utilized your capacity as a human being to be present, to be alert to the fact of life itself, to be curious, to be concerned with the people around you, the suffering in the world. You've just drifted off. And yet, so familiar is this, that when someone says, for example, to you, well, what did you do yesterday? What did you do last week? You can deliver this very convincing story that, well, I did this, and then I did that, and then I went off and did this, and after that we did this, and then we went out for dinner, and then we went to bed. And you have the impression, as you tell that story, not just to others, but when you recall it to yourself, that your life has been an unbroken sequence of fully conscious moments. Whereas in fact, the bits you remember are like tiny islands in a great sea of forgetting. We link it all together in retrospect as an unbroken continuum of conscious experience. But if we paid a little bit more attention, and I think that this practice of cultivating mindfulness allows us that kind of attention, we start to notice that our conscious life is actually very fragmentary. It's bits and pieces, things that strike us. If you're going to work on the bus, it's the same old bus, the same people, it's as boring as usual, so you drift off. But if suddenly the bus crashes into the car in front, then you become fully conscious, obviously. There's some now, something else is happening, and you notice that. And when you get to work, you said, we had this crash on the bus. Consciousness was kicked in at that point. But if you hadn't had that impact, that unexpected, unusual thing, you would have really no recollection, possibly, whatsoever of that bus journey. So the practice of recollection, the practice of mindfulness, and I'm going to start calling it recollection, the practice of recollection is, in fact, the practice of remembering to be aware. So that if you're sitting here in meditation and you drift off and then you suddenly come to again, oh right, yes, the retreat, you quite consciously recollect what it is that you have chosen to be aware of. You recollect the breath. You remember to be aware of the breathing. That is sati, smriti, remembering to be aware. It's a conscious decision, it's a choice to be aware. And that's the key function of sati, remembering, recollecting to be aware. And the way in which that works is by internalizing certain instructions. Martin was saying, for example, be aware of the fact that you're breathing. Be aware of the sensations of your breath. When you get distracted, come back. And so when you do get distracted, you recall those words. Come back. Be aware of the breath. When you first start doing this practice, it might feel a little artificial, a little bit contrived. You're telling yourself to watch the breath. It's very self-conscious. But as the practice matures, as you become more familiar with this, that instruction, that note to yourself, becomes more, as it were, second nature. You do that more instinctively, more naturally. You notice more quickly when you lose consciousness. You come back maybe with less of a gap. So that the aim of the practice is to extend the moments and periods of consciousness into greater and greater lengths, so that those islands in the sea of forgetting become more and more like continents. And maybe they even start joining up, or you build bridges between them, whatever metaphor suits you. But that is, in a way, what we're doing, is that we're utilizing techniques of meditation to enhance and to make more present the consciousness of our life, to be here more than less, to be present rather than absent, to be aware rather than unaware. And this is really a means whereby we can learn to live our lives more fully. It's not just about becoming proficient in a certain set of Buddhist meditation techniques. That's part of it, but a very small part of it. What we're doing on a retreat like this is very much like laboratory work or training in the gym. It's a formal period we're taking out from our lives in order to develop this particular skill. And by develop, I think what I really mean is integrate. We learn to integrate this particular way of being in the world, a way that is more mindful, is more present, and overcomes this tendency to forget. Now the Buddha, and I'm here going to be looking at a text called the Satipatthana Sutta, the discourse on the grounding of recollection. There's a passage from it in the printout, but don't worry about that. I'm not going to go through it word by word. The Buddha talks of sati. Sati is one of the factors that is very important in the cultivation of the path. It doesn't work in isolation. We also require intelligence, a certain confidence or trust in ourselves to do this, a certain confidence in the method itself. We require a certain resolve, a certain energy to do it. We require the ability to be more concentrated, to be more focused. But sati, recollection, is in a way perhaps the key element. And the Buddha describes the practice of sati, of recollection, as patthana. Sometimes this is translated as the foundation of mindfulness, but in fact, it's not really so much a noun here, but a verb. Sometimes it's translated as establishing mindfulness or establishing recollection. But the word patana, tana, is suggests also a grounding, and that's where we get the word foundation from. I think grounding is quite good, that we are grounding recollection. In other words, we are recollecting something that brings us back into our ground. We're bringing the idea, the thought, back to earth. We're grounding ourselves through the practice of recollection, rather than spacing out, drifting off, forgetting. We're trying to ground ourselves. This grounding, the Buddha calls the direct path. The word, in fact, is ekayana. It literally means something like the only way. But I think many of us are perhaps feel uncomfortable with that sort of exclusivity. But nonetheless, I feel that in the context of the Buddha's teaching, this is the one way. This recollection and the grounding of this recollection in our actual experience. And I don't think it's accidental that the Buddha begins his presentation of recollection with recollecting that we have a body. So when we do this meditation, we start by becoming more aware of our bodies. And this is supposed to be a spiritual practice, but we start with the body, the breath, and not the breath in an abstract sense, but the actual physical sensation of breathing. We notice the breath coming in, we notice the breath going out. In other words, we are grounding ourselves in the primary act of being alive. We're remembering that we are alive, that we are living. And you might say, well, I'm always aware of that. I know that I've got a body. But I feel in some ways we don't, that we somehow forget that we are alive. We forget that we will die. Because to breathe means to be breathing every moment one breath less than we'll breathe again. Our lives are running out. Breath is something that will certainly stop. There will come a moment for each one of us where we will breathe out, just as we breathe out now, but we won't breathe in again. Our breath is not only a sign of life, but breath and life as we witness them immediately is also a sign that life is running out, that our time on this earth may be quite short. We don't know. We may only have a few weeks or months to live. We certainly will only have a few years. And when you get to be 56, which is my age, you begin to realize you've almost, well, certainly I would say, are more than halfway through this now. And the chances are I won't be here in another 20 or 30 years. I may not be here next week. We don't know. So recollecting your breath, recollecting your life, you're also recollecting the extraordinary fact that you are here at all. And we don't, and we tend to forget that. We tend to forget that our life is, in a way, a gift, but a gift that's not in our hands. It can run out at any time. And we know so many stories, I'm sure, of people who have lived maybe a very busy life, a very active life, and yet when they are diagnosed with cancer or they know that their death is approaching, they may say that they haven't lived the life that they most deeply wish to live, that they've wasted their time, that they've spent so much energy doing things that in the end were really not that important. So recollecting our breath, recollecting our life, is also recollecting or getting into touch with what it means to live, what it means to walk on this earth, what it means to be a breathing, conscious, feeling person. What is that really for? What is it really about? How can I optimize my capacities in this life to the full? How can I make this life deeply worthwhile? To do so might mean sometimes making sacrifices. It might mean having to take decisions that are often difficult. We might have to do things that will be frightening, that we fear that we will lose our security if we follow our deepest intuitions and longings. But it comes back again to the same question. What is your life for? And again, there is no answer to that. Each of us has to grapple with that question and come to some resolution in the lights of our own values, in the lights of our own experience, of what moves us deeply, and to seek to live a life that is fully engaged with the realization of such values. And we can call that our religious life, our spiritual life, and it may take many different forms. But I think the real challenge to all human beings is how can we live our lives with a depth of seriousness, a depth of commitment, even if that entails discomfort, if entails perhaps our parents or our friends disagreeing with us. So the practice of recollection, the practice of mindfulness, is about grounding ourselves in the primary fact that we are alive. The Buddha gives a very clear description of how one embarks on such a practice. And remember that we start with the body, but that is not the end of the exercise. The breath and the walking are just, as it were, the foundation. This is where we start. We come back to touch the earth as we walk up and down. Again, if we haven't done this much before, we might be thinking, well, this is a kind of a weird thing to be doing, just walking up and down. It's much more interesting to be doing something else. But as we begin to quieten our thoughts, as we become more still, maybe more clear in our minds, we begin to appreciate, we begin to experience almost a sense of wonder and astonishment that we are walking at all. Now, if you think about it, the fact that I can move 80 kilograms of flesh and bone up and down without falling over, I think is an extraordinary thing. with all of our science and technology, there's no way they've come close to creating a robot that can do that. It's an extraordinary thing to be able to walk. And yet we forget how extraordinary it is. We're indifferent to it. We're blasé about it. It's boring. There's a 12th century Chinese Zen poem that says, "The greatest miracle is not to fly through the air. The greatest miracle is not to walk on water. The greatest miracle is to walk on this earth." And I think that's very true. And yet we seek the miraculous, the mysterious, somewhere else, in some grand ideas about absolute truth, instead of recognizing that the truly miraculous is the fact that we breathe and the fact that we walk. It's what Thich Nhat Hanh again calls the miracle of mindfulness. So it's not just some sort of technical exercise, watching the breath and walking up and down a patch of ground. It might feel a bit like that at times. But as you get into it, as your mind stills and you become more attuned, more alert, you begin to realize what a miraculous thing this is that we're doing. And we also realize how alienated we are from that miracle. When we spend so much time wandering off in a cloud of forgetfulness, when the most extraordinary thing is happening around us. There's a passage I read recently from a text in Epicurean philosophy, which is one of the ancient Greek schools, where the writer says that, you know, imagine that you had never known this world at all, this experience, and then suddenly it was revealed to you, just like now. People sitting in the room, air conditioner, ceiling, floor, walls, things we think of as not particularly interesting. But imagine that you had never witnessed such a thing, anything like this before. It would be the most extraordinary thing. And the text goes on to say that that would be enough. You don't need more than that. And yet we've become somehow blind, somehow our senses have become dulled through habit, through other requirements and desires and needs and fears. And that anesthetizes our senses, our minds, our spirit, so that we don't notice that. This practice of awareness is about trying to wake up not to something other than what is actually happening here and is actually happening now. So this is the Buddha's own words describing how this practice begins. He says, "And how does a monk," and by monk we can mean a person, "how does a person abide contemplating the body as a body? A monk or person goes to the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty hut, and he sits down, and having folded his legs crosswise, set his body erect, he grounds recollection in front of him." I don't quite know why it says in front of him. It doesn't really matter. "Ever mindful, he breathes in. Mindful, he breathes out. Breathing in long, he understands, I breathe in long. Or breathing out long, he understands, I breathe out long. And as is the case with Buddhist texts, we then get a million other examples, breathing in short, etc., etc. But the point is, this practice is the very simple recollection that when you're breathing out a long breath, or a short breath, or whatever kind of breath, you're breathing out a long breath. Or you're breathing out a short breath. Or you're breathing in a rather jaggedy breath. Or you're breathing out a rather slow and imperceptible breath. That might sound a little strange, that that's all there is to it. But again, this is very simple, but it is far from easy. The mind would rather do anything but know that it's breathing out a long breath or breathing in a short breath. There's so many more, far more interesting things that we could dream about. And yet here we are, the Buddha, who I think perhaps deserves a little bit of attention, who's saying, this is where it begins. You know that you're breathing, instead of just breathing and getting on with everything else. Now, of course, what's in a way rather telling, as I've already alluded to, is that after being aware for a few minutes that you're breathing out a long breath or breathing in a short breath, the mind decides to do something else. In fact, it almost feels at times as though there's something slightly threatening in this. You know, you could have been doing this for a number of years. You know, be a very serious meditator. And even then, very often, the mind still doesn't like doing it. Rather do something else, like try and remember, you know, the name of all the members of the Led Zeppelin rock group. If you've come from my sort of culture, I'm sure it's different now. But the sort of stuff the mind would rather do, and you've probably noticed this, can be exceedingly trivial. As though anything, would be better than breathing out a long breath and knowing that you're breathing out a long breath. But why? Why is that so unsettling? Why are we so reluctant to do it? That, I think, raises some rather difficult questions. Why do we keep running away from ourselves? Why do we keep fleeing? And I think each of us perhaps can dwell on that question for ourselves. My own sense is because by making this direct contact with the actual fact of our lives, we do become more intimately aware of the fragility of our lives, the impermanence of our lives, the fact that our whole existence hinges on the ability to breathe in and breathe out. If we fail to breathe, I think it's something like for 2 minutes or 3 minutes, we will die, or we will suffer severe brain damage. It all hinges, our whole life hinges on the pumping of a muscle, the heart, and supplying that muscle with oxygen. That's all there is to it. You cut the human being open and it's just flesh and blood. There's nothing terribly solid in there. There's no kind of nice hardwired microcircuitry. It's just flesh and breath. That's all there is. The whole edifice of our ego, of how important we are, it all comes down to the pumping of a muscle in the chest. And that's rather disturbing. We don't really want to know that. We have other meditations, which also described in the same text, just in a couple of pages later, where the Buddha has us recollect the different parts of the body. Starting, the hair and the skin and the bone and the brain and the blood and the different fluids and the stomach and the liver and the kidneys and the intestine and the bowels, etc., etc., etc. The 32 parts are listed, which good Buddhist monks memorize. And again, you might ask, well, what's the point of that? The point of that is we tend to forget that that is who we are. We have this image of ourselves that doesn't look like brain and mucus and fluid and kidneys and lungs, but looks like the me that stares back from the mirror, who looks kind of cool. nice and washed and clean and, got some nice shirt on, shaved, big smile, some trendy glasses. what the Buddha wants us to recollect is actually, if you cut this thing open, it doesn't quite look like that. I had a friend, Charles Genoux, maybe some of you have met him. When he came back from India after practicing Buddhism for a number of years, he went back to Geneva where he lives and he got a job in the city morgue because he really wanted to practice this. for the first week, he said he could hardly handle it. Bodies coming in and then cutting them open and, preparing them for the funerals. And he said, they used to, if they're a bit of a mess, they'd fill them up with newspaper and stuff and then stitch it up. And But we're all like that. And yet we don't want to know it. Buddhist monks in Asia sometimes go to autopsies just to sort of contemplate what the body is. There's recently been an exhibition of art travelling the world where it's a German artist has taken some corpses and somehow preserved them with different coloured fluids and so on and opened them all up. And I've not seen it. I've seen photos. But again, it's very powerful. Looking at yourself from the inside. Now, I don't think the Buddha is necessarily suggesting we, go to autopsies, but he did encourage going to charnel grounds. In the old days in India, they don't do it anymore. The bodies would just be laid out in these grounds where the jackals and the crows and the vultures would eat them. They still do that in Tibet, I've seen it. And the monks would go there and they would meditate. And actually they describe in quite some detail the stages of decomposition. It's not kind of gruesome and kind of revolting perhaps, and perhaps we wouldn't do it ourselves. But the point is, all we're looking at is what's actually closer to us than anything else. Our kidneys, our livers, our stomachs, our whatever. And yet often when we witness that, we want to throw up. We can't take it. So there's a kind of lack of honesty, of forgetting that this is what we are. So this recollection of the body is bringing us back again and again and again to a kind of honesty, a fundamental honesty about what the human being is. Of course, it's not just blood and guts. There's feelings and thoughts and great ideas and consciousness. But at the base, there is the body. And this is where the Buddha begins. He then gives a very good example of how you actually do this attention. He says, just as a skilled turner, as a wood turner, a woodworker, or his apprentice. When making a long turn, understands, I'm making a long turn. Do you understand that? A turn. It's like you're working with a lathe, say, and you have to shape a piece of wood with a tool. He's looking at craftsmanship. He's comparing the practice of mindfulness to the practice of a skilled artisan, someone who has refined their ability to work with wood, to be able to use the tools in such a way that you are able to work that raw material exactly as you wish. There's a kind of precision involved. Of course, when the wood turner is making a turn on the lathe, it's likely that he's not thinking, I'm making a long turn on the lathe. But the point is, he knows exactly what he's doing. He is in full command, or she is in full command, of their skill, their tools. Their body, their hands are perfectly in balance in such a way that with the minimum of effort, one can create precisely the effect one wishes. I think it's useful to think about this analogy, that our practice of mindfulness, our attending to the specifics of our breathing, of our walking, is something like the skill of an artisan in working with his or her materials. And again, think of your experiences of perhaps yourself, you have done such work, you've developed some skill in that area, or perhaps you've observed other people, let's say a potter. It's fascinating to watch a skilled potter turning a piece of clay on a wheel. If you haven't done it yourself, you know, you think, oh, that's easy enough, you just get the clay and try it. You'll make a mess. The clay will go all over the place and you'll end up with some rather ghastly thing. There's a skill required. And the aim of that skill is to produce an object which is both functional and beautiful. And I can imagine the Buddha and his monks walking around North India at those times and sitting in villages and observing these craftspeople at work. In fact, it might even suggest that the Buddha at a younger time may have developed some of these skills himself. But ask yourself, what is it when I meditate that is like the skill of a craftsman in relation here of my mind, my attention, to my breath, to my walking, to my body? Because, of course, life is also like a task. It's always moving. The breath is never the same one breath after another. That things keep happening, sounds keep occurring, we keep moving, life is constantly flowing, and we need, like the moving pot on the wheel, to somehow work with that, to attend to that, to be present to it, not in a passive way. And that's again an interesting aspect of this. Meditation is not a passive kind of staring at things a little bit harder. It's not passive at all. It's a relationship that we develop with our own experience, in the way that the craftsperson has a relationship with his tools and with his materials. It's an engagement. It's not just standing back and looking, eyeballing reality a bit more hard. But it's about a relationship, an engagement with our experience. And such a quality is then applied in every area of our life. I mean, Martine said last night that, you know, when you are going to bed, when you're working in the kitchen, when you're eating your food, you try to bring this quality of conscious awareness into every act. It's not just about becoming the world's greatest breath watcher. That wouldn't get you very far, I'm afraid. Qualification for job. I can watch my breath for. And this is the Buddha again. He says, a monk is one, or a person is one, who acts in full awareness when going forward and coming back, who acts in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away, who acts in full awareness when flexing and extending his limbs, when wearing his robes and carrying his bowl, when eating, drinking, consuming, tasting, who acts in full awareness when defecating and urinating, who acts in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, keeping silent. In other words, we're developing a skill, an attitude, a relationship to our experience as we sit on the cushion here or we walk up and down outside that then enables us to take that quality of consciousness into everything we do. The aim of the practice is to learn how to imbue or to infuse our experience at all times, in all situations, with these same qualities of attention. And then, and I'm not going to go into this now, but the Buddha then continues in this same text to explain how once you've somehow grounded your attention in your body, in your physical existence, you then turn your attention to your feelings, how you feel at any moment. You then turn your attention to what's going on in your mind, and each one is slightly more subtle than the next. You turn your attention to your thoughts, to your emotions, to your inner life. And then you begin to recollect, you know, the Dhamma itself, the different qualities that we cultivate, the different perspectives on life that the teaching opens up. And it culminates in the end with our recollection of the Four Noble Truths. But I'm going to stop here today, and we'll carry on with this in a similar vein tomorrow morning. And if you have any questions, we'll have a session at the end of the afternoon where we can explore anything that's been unclear or you'd like to know more about. Thank you. So now we have a period of walking.